Recording, you're gonna get a notice to okay that, and I need to make sure that I am spotlighted. If I'm spotlighted, you may just go back to gallery view. That'll put everybody back the same size. You can all hear and see me.
Yes.
And we're gonna hope and pray, and prayer never hurt, that my computer behaves tonight. Okay, that's the goal. All right. We are more or less starting a new chapter tonight. So let's jump right in, share screen. And you should see what should be chapter 20, Parakraf. Debbie, welcome. Okay. So I still have you all on my camera on my left side, so on my screen on my left side, so I can still see the cameras. So if you want to leave them on, that's great, because then I get to see you all as I'm going through this. And feel free to unmute as you want to participate. I'm just going to mute background noise for now, and feel free to unmute at will. Okay. I've shown you the little trick to unmute, right? You hold the space bar down and it unmutes. Okay, good. All right. So let's go back to the end of Perek Yud-Tet, just to kind of put us into it. It's hard to see this on this website, but really this is one paragraph. We're starting in the middle of a paragraph in a Koran Tanakh, and it's much easier to see. I'm not sure you're going to see it on the screen. But in a Koran Tanakh, let's see if I can do this. Can you all see? Oh, no, that's not going to work. No, that's not going to work. No, you're not going to see it from there. All right. Well, so much for show and tell. But this is really part of the end of chapter 19. So if we go back to the last couple of psukim of chapter 19, where we left off was David coming to Gilgal together with the entourage of Shevet Yehuda, and suddenly being confronted with a all full-scale conflict between Ish Yisrael and Ish Yehuda, between the sort of the two group that have been vying for David's attention, so to speak. Ish Yisrael came and they said, "Madua k'navucha achenu? Why did you allow the people of Judah to steal you away?" Right? Madua gnavucha achenu ish Yehuda. They sort of crowned you and did the whole ceremony and acknowledgement when you were on the other side of the Yarden before you even got to the before you even got to Gilgal. But yeah, and it's interesting that David doesn't respond here. Ish Yehuda responds, "Vayan kol Ish Yehuda al Ish Yisrael, ki karav ha-melech elai, v'lam ezech ha-malacha." David is very close to us. He's one of us. Why should it bother you that he is a member of the tribe of Judah? Al ha-davar hazeh, ha-achol achalnu min ha-melechim, niseit lanu, if we, of all the years that David was king, if we taken any particular gifts or privileges because of it? Dayan ish Yisrael et ish Yehuda v'yomer esa yardot li b'melech. We have 10 parts in the king. We are 10 times your size. We are 10 tribes, right? You are just one. And I think I mentioned this once before, but it's worth putting into context. That's really the definition of what a melech is. A melech, as different from a shofet in the context of biblical leadership, you have two models. You have a king and you have a shofet. The king is national and the shofet is tribal. And so the transition in the days of Shaul was supposed to be a shift from tribal leadership to national leadership. Shaul failed at that. Shaul was not very good at navigating the national value agenda over his tribal affiliation. And so you see many times that Shaul favors Binyamin. His officers are all from Binyamin. He talks to them as if they're all from his tribe, where and his capital is in Shevet Binyamin. Whereas David, the moment they make him king of all of Israel, he moves his capital from Hebron to Yerushalayim. He joins forces. He takes the civil war that had been existed between Yehuda and Benjamin throughout the days of Shaul, and he unites them together, because that's really what the king is. He kind of unites the palace and the kingdom together under for all the tribes. And that's what Ish Yisrael responds. And he says, we are 10 parts of the king's of the king's kingdom. And we have more right in David than you. In a certain sense, right? He's, why did you despise us? Why did you curse us? We were the first ones to bring the king back. You came, Johnny come lately, right? You showed up at the end of the day. And in this conflict, the words, the arguments of the men of Judah were harsher, fiercer, mightier, more legal, more binding. Machloket of the Mishnah, how to understand that. But essentially, they were, this chapter ends in this moment of conflict. And in that moment of conflict between Ish Yehuda and Ish Binyamin, the question that is often asked is, where is David? Right? David is silent in all of this back and forth, and it really becomes David had tried, this is sort of a summary of where we were last week, or a couple of weeks ago. So David had tried to bring the people of Judah back into the world of his loyal context, because they were the ones who rebelled against him, right? They were the ones who were following Absalom. And the long-standing gripe of Judah against David for having abandoned the Hebron and gone to Yerushalayim and having abandoned the preferential status of Shevet Yehuda. So David at this point tries to balance that by bringing Yehuda back. Unfortunately, that balance doesn't play out well for Ish Yisrael, and it's one of those moments where the story ends in conflict. And into that conflict, we move straight into, in the regular Tanakh, it's one paragraph, which is the continuation of the story of Sheva ben Bichri. V'sham nikra ish bliya'al, u'shmo Sheva ben Bichri ish yimini. There, in the midst of all of that, was an ish bliya'al. And Ish Blial is, here it's translated as a wicked fellow. Blial is typically understood as Bli Ya'al, without worth, worthless. A worthless, evil person. Anybody remember anybody else referred to as Ish Blial in Sefer Shmuel? No? Not familiar? By the way, this is the last chapter of the chronology of Sefer Shmuel, meaning the last story of David's life, chronologically, is this chapter. So this is the closing chapter of Sefer Shmuel. There's another four chapters that are an appendix that are earlier moments that were kind of going to fall into in various periods of David's life, but they are an appendix to the text. This is really the last story, so it ends with this reference to Ish Blial. Anybody remember where we encountered Ish Blial before?
Pinchas and
Chofni. Very good. Right? Perek Bet of Shmuel Aleph, which is the story of the fall of the Mishkan, right? The book started with the story of the children of Eli, Chofni and Pinchas. Bnei Eli, Bnei Bliya'a, lo yada'u et Hashem, sons of Eli, baseless, worthless men, did not know God, immoral, corrupt children of Eli, and that of course led to the fall of the Mishkan and the war with the Plishtim, and the rest, as they say, is history. So that is, so if I come back to our chapter, Parakhaf, Sham Nikra Ish Blial. So it's just ironic, somewhat, I don't necessarily know that it's significant, but that Sefer Shmuel begins with the story of Ish Blial and ends with the story of Ish Blial, kind of has this contrast around this moment. Who is this Ish Blial, or after all of this introduction? Ushmo Sheva ben Bichri Ish Yimini. Sheva ben Bichri, Ishimini, of course, means from Shevet Binyamin. What do we know about Shevet Ben Bichri? What do we know about who he is, where he comes from, what his lineage is, anything? It's okay to say no. It's okay to say no. The answer is nothing. Right. We know nothing. We've never seen him before, nor will we really ever see him again. Right. This is a one-chapter story. Shevet Ben Bichri just kind of appears in the middle of the story. Ishimini blows the shofar, v'itka b'shofar, blows the shofar and proclaims, v'yomer, ein lanu chelek b'David, v'lo nachala lanu b'ven Yishai. We don't want a portion in David. We have no inheritance. We have no nachal. We have no connection to Ben Yishai. Ish lo alav Yisrael. Every man to his tents. Public declaration, v'itka b'shofar. The shofar plays a very interesting role in this whole story. Who else blew a shofar? This has a positive answer. Who else blew a shofar? In Sefer Shmuel? Give you a clue. We read it a couple of chapters ago. Yeah, how did Avshalom begin his rebellion? Avshalom sent spies to all of Israel saying, Kishomachem et kol hashofar. When you hear the sound of the shofar, then you will know that Malach Avshalom Hebron. Right? That is the shofar Avshalom began his rebellion with. The shofar is a very significant role. The shofar is essentially a tool for the declaration of coronation of kings. Right? That is not uncommon. You have Avshalom starts his rebellion with the shofar. When Yoav put down the rebellion of Avshalom, when he declared the war after he killed Avshalom, declared the war over, he blew the shofar to end the battle with Avshalom. We're going to see here, Shevet Ben Bichri blows the shofar to start the rebellion against David. And we'll see at the end of the parak that once it's all over, that have it again. Yeah, no, I don't think we have it again. Well, yes. Right, Yoav at the end of the battle after the rebellion is put down. Blows the shofar and disperses the people, and he says, "Oh, back to Yerushalayim, the war is over." So the shofar is a very powerful tool. It's a symbolic tool. It's a tool of war. It's a tool to call the people to arms. Ehud ben Gera, Otniel ben Knaz, Sefer Shoftim, they go to battle. They blow the shofar to bring the army, to call the army to come. It's a tool of coronation, right? Declare a new king, declare rebellion. Not an accident that the shofar is used in Rosh Hashanah to symbolize the coronation of God, because the shofar is exactly that. It's a tool to declare the coronation of kings. And in Rosh Hashanah is all about God as Melech Malchei Melechim, as the King of Kings. And so that's the tool that is used. Okay. So that's how the story begins. Ish b'liyal shmo Shevet ben Bichri, v'itka b'shofar, v'yomer en lanu chelek b'David, v'lo nachala lanu b'ven Yishai, ish lo alav Yisrael. And in fact, that's exactly what happens. V'yal kol ish Yisrael me'achare David, achare Shevet ben Bichri. Ish Yisrael then turns from following David, kind of turn their backs on him, walk away. They're so angry, disappointed at the way in which this ceremony of coronation took place. V'ish Yehuda davku b'malkam min Yarden v'ad Yerushalayim. And the rest of Ish Yehuda continued to stick with David and journeyed from the Jordan to Yerushalayim. So we'll come back to the reference to min Yarden to Yerushalayim in a second. Just an observation about going back to Shevet ben Bichri. I said we don't know anything about him. And that's true. We don't know anything about him. But the names are not strange to us. Why do I say that? Sheva might be an odd name. You have Batsheva, you can have other names of similar. But Bichri is a very powerful name for Shevet Binyamin. Why? Because if I go all the way back to Bereshit and to the lineage of the tribes of Israel who came down to Mitzrayim, so the first generation of Jews who came to Mitzrayim, and there in Bereshit Perek Mem Vav, we have the list of the children. These are the list of all of the Ela Shemot Bnei Yisrael Ava Im Mitzrayim, right? The names of the households that went down to Mitzrayim. And if I look at Binyamin, because that's what our subject is, if I look at Binyamin, Uvnei Binyamin, who are the names of the 10 children of Binyamin? Bela, Vavecher, Ve'ashbel, Gera, Naaman, Nachai, Rosh, Mupim, Kupim, and Ar. Yes, the names are not relevant to us, but the name Becher, or Vecher, or Becher, is the name of the second son of Binyamin. And so if I look at names as a reflection of the tribe kind of lineage, these are names that remain part of the community. You name after grandparents, name after great-grandparents, name after family households. So if Becher is a family name within the tribe of Binyamin, then a surprise that we would find a prominent family within the tribe of Binyamin by the name of Becher or Sheva ben Bichri. So why is that significant? It's significant because what I'm trying to draw is the role of Binyamin in this second rebellion. This is really about Shevet Binyamin. He's described as Sheva ben Bichri, Ish Yimini. Ish Yimini is clearly a reference to Binyamin, not Ish Yisrael and not Ish Yehuda, but Ish Yimini, Binyamin. Who else is referred to as Ish Yimini? At least two very prominent personalities that are described as Ish Yimini.
Mordechai, the guy that cursed him also.
Shev Eud ben and that Shimi ben Gera was also described as Ish Yimini.
Oh, well, he was, wasn't he from that tribe?
He was from that tribe. So can you use the word Ishimini there? It might. But the other, and that would play to the same message. Ishimini, referring to Shevet Binyamin, clearly. But two very prominent personalities that come from that are described as Ishimini. One is Mordechai. Ish Yehudi Haya B'Shishan Bira, Shmo Mordechai Ben Yair Ben Shimi Ben Kish. Ishimini, right? And the other is that link, Ben Kish, Ishimini, Shaul's Binyamin's great 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 grandfather, who is Kish, father of Shaul. If I go back to the beginning of the story of Shaul HaMelech, we are introduced to Shaul HaMelech as Vayhi Ish mi Binyamin Ushmo Kish Ben Aviel Ben Tzur Ben Bochorat Ben Afiach Ben Ish Yimini Gibor Chayil, right? That Kish Ish Yimini is the father of Shaul. That's precisely how his father is described to us. Ben Ish Yimini Shmo, right? Is that's Mordechai, and so there's a kind of a ring to this Ish Yimini, and it tells us that this is we don't know a lot more about him, but we do know that this is being driven by a sense of the feeling, the angst of Binyamin specifically to the insult that David has allowed Ish Yehudi to perpetrate against Ish Yisrael as a whole, but Ish Yimini in particular. They were the ones who were closest in David. They were the ones who were the border with Yerushalayim. It was with Ish Yimini, Shevet of Shaul HaMelech, that David made peace when he brought the kingdoms together. Right? This was a particular slight to Ish Yimini. And so the rebellion of Sheva ben Bichri begins. What is its breadth? What is the extent to which it is successful, to which it is drawing energy? We don't know anything about it yet. Everybody with me?
Got a question?
Yeah.
I think I asked last time, and you said you'd address it next time. What? Why did he have so much pull? Who is he? that he just says, let's rebel, and everybody listen.
Well, again, yes, we will get to it. I'm not sure we'll get to it today, but we'll ask the question today, and then we'll go from there. All the people of Israel turned their backs on David, following the lead of Sheva ben Bichri, v'ish Yehuda dafku, but of course, Ish Yehuda continued with their king. Mina Yarden v'ad Yerushalayim, from the Yarden to Yerushalayim. Why is that significant? Mina Yarden ad Yerushalayim. Because what it means is that what did David do at that moment? And Sheva ben Bichri made his public declaration, turned away, turned his backs to David and the tribe of Judah, and the people of Israel started to walk away as if they're going to follow Sheva ben Bichri. What did David do to address the rebellion?
Nothing.
Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Why not? Here you get a sense of the savvy of David's leadership. Throughout these chapters, you have this kind of moments where David makes significant mistakes in judgment, because in the aftermath of Bathsheba, he's not the leader that he was prior. But every once in a while, you feel and sense the savviness of David's leadership, which is what he was in his heyday. This is a very clever move. Why? Because David has no power in standing at the bank of the Jordan River in the city of Gilgal, surrounded by a group of people from Judah after the rebellion of Absalom, and all of the tribes of Israel just turn his backs on him. He's sitting there in the middle of no man's land. He does to reassert himself, to send out an army, to deal with the rebellion, to assert his kingship, etc. He needs to come back to the throne of his power, which is Yerushalayim. And so he literally does nothing yet until he comes back to Yerushalayim. And that's where the story really begins. When he comes back to Yerushalayim, the story will continue in Pasuk Dalet. In the meantime, for Pasuk Gimel, we have a inserted parentheses. And this inserted parenthetical aside is a story into itself. It's a bit of a tragic story, but nonetheless, it's one which is there, and it's part of David's world at this point. Vayavod David al beito Yerushalayim. David comes back to his house in Yerushalayim. Now, if you remember, when he left Yerushalayim, who did he leave behind?
Wait,
And he took his
wait.
army, he took his men, he took his soldiers. Who did he leave behind?
Concubines.
Right, he left the harem. He left his 10 concubines. I expect, right, who left Lishmor HaBayit. Lishmor HaBayit is an interesting phrase. Unclear what it means, how the concubines guard the house. Either it means they guard the integrity of the malchus, right, the house or the household, or it means that he left a entourage of soldiers to protect them, meaning they're the bayit, and he left the soldiers, he left the Eser Plegshim guarded in the sense. But in all cases, he left a part of his family he left behind. And of course, now he has a problem. Whether he was right in leaving them or not right in leaving them, not the issue, but the issue is what happened to them. Right, what happened to
Absalom.
them?
Absalom took him to
Avshalom.
the roof.
Avshalom, exactly. And so now he has this dilemma, what to do with them. Vayikach et Eser Nashim Pilagshim Asher Hiniach Lishmor HaBayit, the 10 women who he had left to keep the house. Vayitnem Beit Mishmeret Vayichalkaleh, and he left them in the house with protection, and he provided them sustenance, meaning he fed them and he gave them sustenance and he provided for them, even though he could no longer consider them part of his entourage, part of his harem. He could no longer consider them part of his wives. Why not?
They had consorted with Absalom.
Well, they didn't consort with that. Well, it depends what you mean by consorted, right? They weren't willing partners with Absalom, but they were
No.
certainly defiled by Absalom. And that becomes the question of what is their status there is an opinion. There's two opinions in the Gemara. One opinion says that halachically, like any adulterous relationship, he was not allowed to re-engage with them. And so he couldn't do anything other than what he did. There's another opinion that says that he was allowed. Technically, he could have retaken them as his harem because Avshalom forced himself on them. Right? Avshalom took them by force. And that means that they're not adulterous in the classic sense of the term. And from a strictly halachic perspective, it would have been okay for David to take them back, except that David post Bathsheba is a different David. Highly sensitive to the optics of anything related to the women in his household. There's a medrash that says that David was, you know, had failed with Bathsheba by allowing his yetzer to engage with somebody who was forbidden to him. And so his tshuva involved restricting himself from somebody who even may have been permissible to him, right? To take him to the other end of the the extreme. Radak quotes both opinions. But nonetheless, the idea being here that David has no option, on the one hand, as he provides for them, he sustains them. On the other hand, they remain part of his household, but he will never be with them. Ve'alehem lo va. And in that context, v'tiyena tzrurot ad yom mutan al minut chayut. Very tragic description of them being remain living widows until the end of their lives, because they can't go outside of the harem, they can't go outside of the kingdom. They were concerts of the king. They were the part of the king's pilegesh. So they're not entitled, not able to live anywhere outside of the palace and with anybody else. On the other hand, the king is not able to be with them either. And so you have this very classic, very tragic picture of them being kind of tsurot, held in the palace, not in the prisoner sense of it, but in the sense of not having the ability to establish their own lives and their own partners and their own husbands, etc. That's sort of where this whole picture ends up. And who's to blame for all of this? Who's to blame for the tragedy of these 10 women?
Pretty much David for leaving them there. But at the same time, just the whole concept of a harem is sort of tragic.
It is for us, because we don't live in that kind of a world. But in the world of Tanakh, it's very normal. It's very classic for a king. You have to be, very careful. We've talked about this before. We have to be very careful of imposing modern values into an arena in which those values are different. The notion of Pilakshim and the multiple wives in the world of kings was very normal and permissible. And all that David had done, right, from a halachic perspective, David limited the number of Pilakshim and Nashim that he had. Right? Chazal say he had 18, and that was the maximum. Shlomo Melech had 1,000, right? 700 and 300. But this was normal. This was the world of empires, the world of kings. And so not the world of individuals. We don't know. With a couple of examples of individuals with Pilakshim and Tanakh. But for the most part, the only examples we have are kings. Meaning even polygamy, which was permissible in the context of the Torah, we only have really only examples from kings outside of the world of the Avot, where you had a couple of stories. But even though it was certainly permissible throughout the biblical arena, but we know of no other examples other than kings, because the kings lived with the kind of political arena in which this was normal and acceptable. And so you can't judge them for living by modern values that don't exist yet. I have the same issue every time we talk about democracy, and I've said this many times, right?
I'm not judging David necessarily. I'm not saying like David, you know, like you're looking, when you were looking at also from a man's point of view, that it's normal for them, but it's still tragic for them.
It is tragic to them, but I think we have to be careful about where we put the blame on the tragedy. The blame of the tragedy lies
with Avshalom. For sure.
The blame of the tragedy lies with Avshalom. You know, to put the blame on David on this one, I would say, is wrong. On the contrary, what the purpose of this verse here is telling us is that he comes back to the palace. He's now going to provide them sustenance. We have other examples of the same idea of women who are part of the harem of the king and can't go outside of that arena. By the way, that's exactly how we understood the reason for David keeping Bathsheba as his wife. Remember, we had that whole discussion about why he's allowed to remain married to her. He could have simply and easily have absolved himself of the whole tragedy of the rebellion of Avshalom and all that came after it if he would have simply let Bathsheba go. But part of his tshuva forever was he couldn't let Bathsheba go because he had essentially ruined her life. And she could no longer go outside of the palace to any other person. It was just not acceptable. And you see that here, right? They because they were part of the Pilakshe HaMelech, they couldn't go outside of the palace. Right? They couldn't be with anybody else. And so David keeps them, provides for them, and provides them sustenance, provided them with sustenance for exactly that same reason. And that's why part of his tshuva for Bathsheba is to remain married to Bathsheba and take the consequences, because it's the moral obligation that's driving that commitment to her at that moment. It's the same thing here. The fact that Avshalom defiled them, violated them, took them in public means that they will no longer ever be able to have normal lives. That's the consequences of Avshalom's actions. David comes back to the palace and he says, stay here. You'll be A, safe, and B, I will provide you sustenance for the rest of your lives. So the tragedies of Shalom's, David, at least on some level, tried to reflect or provide for them in that regard. That's the parentheses around Avshalom, around the Pilakshim. There's a reference, it was a Megillat Esther context I was going to mention, but if you look in Chapter 2 of Megillat Esther, when the harem and the women are kind of going 6 months in this oil, 6 months in that oil, in order to have their one night with Achashverosh, what happens to them after their one night with Achashverosh? Megillat Esther?
They're killed.
No.
But they live there forever the same way.
Exactly. They end up living there forever in the same way. If you look at Esther, Perek Bet, after they have that one night, and Narav and Narav, each young woman's turn came to go to Achashverosh, and 12 months in this oil, 12 months to 6 months in that, 6 months in this, perfumes, etc. Ubazen Amar Lavo Lamelech, this is each one would come to the king. Ba'erev Iva'a, in the evening she would come to the king. Uva Boker, Ishava el Beit Hanashim Sheni. In the morning, she would go to the other king's harem, El Yad Shashgaz Yisamelech, which was guarded by Shashgaz Yisamelech and Shomer Pilakshim, and Lo Tavo Od Al Hamelech Kim Chafetz Bamelech Venikra Abishem. If the king called her, she could come to the king. Otherwise, she would remain there. She couldn't go to anybody else, and so it was sort of like a life sentence. Comes part of the reason why it becomes so tragic. That's more or less what you end up with David's world, with these women, these Pilakshim. The only difference being that David here takes responsibility for them, at least for the perspective of providing them by Yechal Kalim. Okay. Let's go back to the story of Sheva ben Bichri. Vayomer HaMelech el Amasa. Hazek li et ish Yehuda shloshit yamim, v'yata po amod. So the king turns to Amasa, Amasa ben Yeter, and he says to him, go and gather all the men of Judah. Go get the army of Judah together. For 3 days, v'yata po amod et madi, and 3 days be here with the army, ready to go in 3 days hence. What happened, we'll see in a second. But what's going on in this verse? There's a lot to unpack in this one verse. What's the issue? First of all, who is Amasa and what role is he playing? Who is Amasa? What role does he play?
He's Dubbage General, isn't he?
He is now Dubbage General, meaning.
Right. He was
Wow.
Avshalom.
Correct. He was the general in charge of the rebellion of Avshalom. He was the one that Avshalom replaced when Achitophel had a very violent death and removed himself from the picture. And at the end of the rebellion, at the end of the story, when it's all over and David is trying to kind of bring Shevet Yehuda back into the fold, so he turns to Tzadok and Aviatar, and he says to them, go and gather the people of Judah, right? That was the message, the people of Judah, don't be late. You want to be first to the party, not last to the party. Lama tiyu achronim lashivat ha-melech al beito. And then he turns to, this is the previous chapter, and then he turns to Amasa, and he says to Amasa, Atzmi v'suriyata, you are also my bone and my flesh. Amasa, if you recall, was Ovid's other nephew, right? Oh, I'm an Avishai, nephews from one side, Amasa, nephew from another side. Ko yaseh li Elokim ko yosif, im lo sar tzava tiyeh lefanai kol hayamim tachat Yoav. I will make you the captain of my army instead of Yoav. Why does he do that? Why does he appoint Amasa as the captain of the army in lieu of or instead of Yoav? Has Yoav resigned?
He's mad at Yoav.
Right, so on the one hand, he's mad at Yoav for having killed Avshalom. And so he's looking for a way to replace Yoav, which is ironic considering the fact that Yoav saved the day and Yoav saved the battle. If it wasn't for Yoav, the battle would have been over along, in the wrong direction. The other piece of it is why Tamasa ben Yeter? What else is David trying to do?
He wanted to bring the Absalom supporters along.
It's like the story of Lincoln pulling together a cabinet from all from his political opponents, right? This is David trying to reunite the tribes of the factions within the tribe of Judah. So he turns to the people of Judah and he says, come back and accept me as your king. I won't hold you accountable for the rebellion. I won't hold you guilty of treason. I will enable you to return, right? Imagine like, sort of in the world in which the literally a civil war had just torn the people apart. And Shevet Yehuda in particular was torn apart. David is turning to the other half of Shevet Yehuda and he says to them, come back to me. And in the same breath, he says to Amasa, you leader of the opposition, you are the general of the rebellious forces of Avshalom. I'm going to appoint you as my new general because I want, right? It's the same thing he did to Avner, right? When Ishbosheth was when the rebellion of Avner ben Shaul was taking place, and you had the civil war between David's forces and Shaul's forces. Avner had sided with Ishbosheth, and now when David was trying to unite the kingdom, he was going to make Avner the general of his army. What stopped him from doing that? What stopped him from appointing Avner as his chief of staff? That's back in Shmuel Bet Perek. Hey, right? What stopped him from handing? Can you see me? You all hear me? We're good.
Now we can.
Yeah, I don't know what happened to my internet. But what stopped David from appointing Avner as the chief of the army?
Yoav.
Yoav. Yoav killed him. Right? That'll stop him from being the chief of the army because he didn't pass the physical. Eventually, the same thing will happen to Amasa. Or at least potentially possible for the same thing to happen to Amasa. Amasa is appointed in lieu of Yoav. So coming back to our Perek, that's precisely what he says. So he turns to Amasa and says, okay, you're it. You're the new general. I have a job for you. Hazikli et ish Yehuda shloshit yamim. Go and gather the people of Judah together. 3 days hence, you meet me here. And we will address the rebellion of Sheva ben Bichri. In a certain sense, we'll see this as the Perek unfolds. David here is faced with a challenge. He's faced with a rebellion in his ranks, Sheva ben Bichri. He's got to address that rebellion. He knows that the key to that rebellion lies with the head of that group, namely Sheva ben Bichri himself. He has two choices. What are his two choices? What are his two military options?
Capture him or kill him.
No. What are his two military options tactically?
One is to attack, one is to what to defend to wage a defensive war.
Think
Let Sheba attack him.
of the counsel given to Avshalom. Avshalom was faced with exactly the same scenario. Avshalom was king in Yerushalayim. Avshalom was king. David was leading this rebellious group, faction running away from the palace. Avshalom had two choices. What were the two choices?
A surprise attack
A
or
small group.
a full-blown.
Correct. A surprise attack offered by a small fighting force of commandos, special forces, secret service, go in, find David, take out the head of the snake, and then rebellion over. Or that was Ahitophel's advice.
Get a
What was
large army. Get a large army together and wage
get the army
war.
together, go into a full-scale frontal attack until the war is over. Right, those were the options. What are the options facing David at this time? Exactly the same.
Are those always the options?
Mean, those are classically two, when you're dealing with the rebellion, those are classically two options. But the contrast here between Avshalom and David in that moment is very dramatic. Right? David is faced exactly the same two options here. We'll see the alternative in a second. But here, what he says to Amasa is, go and gather the army together. I give you 3 days, go get all of Yehuda, and essentially makes the same mistake almost that Avshalom made. Right? Achitophel's advice was much more reasonable and sound than Hushai's advice, right? Take out David and the rebellion is over. Take out Hushai, take out Sheva ben Bichri, rebellion is over. David instead gathers together the forces to go to a full-scale war. That's only logical if you assume that this is a full-scale rebellion, right? Which is comes back to Judy's question: is there a full-scale rebellion going on? And I'm going to leave it as an open question. I'm not sure. We haven't heard anything beyond Pasuk Aleph and Bet. We down by Gilgal. We haven't heard anything about Amasa ben Yetter. Sorry, about Sheva ben Bichri. Have we heard about where he's gone, what he's doing, who's following him, what kind of army he has? Nothing, right? Nothing. So we don't know. But we know that the king turns to Amasa and he says, okay, go gather the army of Judah together 3 days and meet me here. Okay? What happens? Amasa lazik et Yuda. Amasa goes to gather the army of Judah together. And he misses the deadline. 3 days come, 3 days go. And where is Amasa? Nowhere
Still
to.
trying to convince the men of
We have
Judah
no
to go
idea.
with him.
We have no idea. We do not know. David does not know. All we know is, where is he not? Right? Where he's not is in Jerusalem. Remember the geography. Jerusalem is the border between Judah and in the south and Benjamin in the north. So from Jerusalem, where did Amasa go? What was his mission? What was his
He
mission?
went to Yehuda.
Hazeklit Ish Yehuda. That was the mission. Called to gather the men of Judah, right? Which is fine. Shloshi Damim. And then come back to Yerushalayim. So David is waiting for him in Yerushalayim. And in the meantime, Vayocher min ha-moed asher yado. He missed the deadline. And we're talking about an army. You can't just show up when you want, right? So 3 days later, Amasa is nowhere to be seen. We don't know what happened to him. We don't know if he lived to tell the tale. We don't know if he was attacked. A Masak could be a very popular personality. He could be a very unpopular personality. Who likes him? Who doesn't like him? Who likes him? Who doesn't like him? I guess it would depend on.
Probably.
I guess it would depend
Yeah.
on which side of the army of Judah you were on. If you were on Achitophel's side, if you were on Avshalom's side, if you were on David's side. If you were on Avshalom's side, you liked he was your general. If you were on David's side, he was the general for the enemy. Right? Not so simple. I don't envy Amasa's task. Go and gather all the people of Judah together, what, from the entire tribe, from both sides, united army. He's just finished the rebellion. We haven't had a chance to take off our uniforms from the rebellion in Yair Ephraim. We'll wash our clothes. He's just come back to Yerushalayim. And Amasa was sent to gather them for another war with Shevet Ben Bichri. And doesn't show up. Do we know what happened to him? No. But we have a dilemma. What's David going to do now? So David, what's he going to do now? What do you think?
Well, we can look at it because he
What do
goes
you...
back to Yoav.
Yeah, he's going to go back to somebody. He's got to go back. His options are going to go maybe to go back to Yoav, but he's not going to do that quite yet. Vayomer David el Avishai. So he turns to Avishai. Who is Avishai? I know a lot of names. Shmuel, Sefer Shmuel has more personalities and more names than any other book in Tanakh. Who is Avishai? I'll give you a clue. I'll give you a clue, or I'll show you, right? We've had an Avishai many times. Yoav is David's nephew. Yoav, what's his full name in Tanakh? Yoav ben Tzruya.
Avishai? No. Okay.
Yoav ben Tzruya. What is Avishai's full name in Tanakh? Avishai ben
So, yeah.
Tzruya. Avishai is Yoav's younger brother. Remember, there are two children of Tzruya. David has said many times, Ma li v'lechem b'nei Tzruya? What am I going to do with you, b'nei Tzruya? Avishai was the one who wanted to kill Shaul when they were hiding in the camp, in the caves, in Shmuel Aleph. And David says to him, what am I going to do with you, b'nei Tzruya? Avishai was the one. Avishai is a hothead. Avishai is a warrior. But on the other hand, Avishai and Yoav are his nephews, and they are his two warriors. They are the ones who led the battle. Actually, let me show you this. This is important. They are the ones who led the battle in Shmuel Bet, Perek Chet, which is against the war of Aram, Ammon and Aram together. Vayar, back in Perek Yud, when they were fighting, right before the battle, the story of Batsheva, they were fighting a very big world war against the forces of Ammon together with Aram in the north, etc. Vayar Yoav keitai lav. He saw that he was being fighting on two fronts, north and south. So he gathers the army together and he splits them. Vet yeter am natan biyad Avishai achiv. And he splits, he's going to war together with Avishai's brother. Yoav takes half the battle, and he gives Avishai the other half. He'll take one front, Avishai will take the other. And then he says to him in a very famous speech, if Aram overpowers me, you will come and assist me. If Bnei Ammon overpower you, I will come and save you. Be strong, be courageous. Let us prove ourselves for our people, for our cities, for the cities of God, and God will do what he sees fit. It's a very powerful speech, but it's said between Yoav and Avishai. They were warriors together. You with me? So, come back to our story. Vayomer David al Avishai. Why does he now turn to Avishai? because Amasa's out of the picture. So what are his options? Yes, two. What are his options?
Avishai or Yoav.
Avishai or Yoav.
Seems like it's the same option, though.
What?
Seems like the same option, though, in the next paragraph.
Well, we'll
they
get
work to together.
I want to work this. I want to work this through step by step. We'll get. We'll get to it. There's a reason I'm reading this chat line by line. So don't get ahead of me. Vayomer David al Avishai, ata yera lanu shever ben bichri min Avshalom. Now David realizes the Sheva ben Bichri is a potentially greater threat even than Avshalom. Why? Why is that now suddenly a realization? Why is that suddenly now a realization that he didn't have before?
Because he has to unite the kingdom again, right? And before he had people from various places, right, that were outside.
Why is it now? Why has he suddenly realized that now Sheva ben Bichri will do us more harm than Avshalom?
Because
why now?
Avshalom was personal to him. Now this is his whole kingdom.
That's a difference. There are many differences between Avshalom and Sheva ben Bichri. But why now? Why is he worried about this suddenly? What's changed? Amasa disappears. And nobody knows what happened to him. Which means that if he starts sending out generals to start gathering the army and they don't come back, now he's worried that there's a much bigger scale to this campaign than he anticipated, or danger to this campaign. Right? Amasa's disappearance has got them worried. If Amasa disappears, and if the army of Judah can't be called together, it means that Sheva ben Bichri, whether by politicking and convincing people to go against David, or whether by army, we don't know. We just don't know. But David is scared. He's worried. He's worried. And so he says to Avishai, now we need to act, and we need to act quickly, which means we're going to change tactics. Atah kach et avdei adonecha, take your servants, your master servants, meaning the king's guard, uradof acharav, go find them. Find whom?
Sheva
ben Bichri. Pen matza lo arim b'tzurot v'tzilenenu, lest he find himself some fortified city and escape out of our sight. Which is precisely what Avichitofel said to Avshalom. Let me take a small fighting force now this night before we lose sight of David and go take out David before he has a chance to regroup. So David has now come full circle. He starts with the effort of Hushai's suggestion, go take the gather the entire army together. I'll give you 3 days. When Amasa doesn't show up, now he starts to worry. So he takes Avishai aside and he says, okay, we're going to change this whole strategy. Now you take the fighting force, you take the special forces, you take the Marines, you take the commandos, you take the group, right? The Giborim. And they're you're gonna take them. That's a small group that you can command. Go find him before we lose sight of him. Fine. So who goes with him? Vayetzu acharav anshei Yoav. No surprise. Who are these commandos? Who are these Giborim? They are the army that Yoav commanded. Right? That was the group that when Yoav and Avishai split the army back in the days of the war with Ammon in Perek Yud, right? Yoav took the Giborim and he fought against the north, and Avishai took everybody else and he fought against the south. Right? So these Anshei Yoav, they're the ones who said, remember Uriah Hiti who said to David, when David called him back from the battlefield, he said, Adoni Yoav, my master Yoav. And that was his treasonous statement about Yoav. And Sheyoav, they're Yoav's personal fighting force, personal army. So Abishai takes and Sheyoav. Now you understand that if he's taking and Sheyoav, who's going with them?
Yoav,
right? You're not going to take and Sheyoav and not take Yoav. And we'll see Yoav shows up in the story. And the Akreti Ve'apleti. Now, the Kreti Apleti is a fascinating group. Right, so you can see right away that he takes the what we refer to in Sefer Shmuel as Tzva HaGiborim, the small army of the warriors, the Giborim. Right, that's that group that Yoav fought with in the north. That's the group that, right, not the whole army. That's a small attack force. That's your special forces. The creativity of and the Apleti is an interesting myth, mystery. The simplest explanation for the creativity of Pleiti is that they were some kind of army that existed, that came to David, that were loyal to David. They were probably mercenaries of some kind. They were probably an external force of some other nation. The Crete is an island off of Plishtim, Pleshet, unclear who they are, but they are constantly found with David. We only find them with David. The idea is that there's some kind of additional army that was commanded within the ranks of the army of Israel. We find several references to them at the very end of this parak, when the summary of David's kingdom is described. Yoav in charge of the army, and Benaiah ben Yehoiada was in charge of the Kreti and the Pleiti. Okay, so that's Benaiah ben Yehoiada, la Kreti v'ala Pleiti. So from a Pshat perspective, that's most likely who they are. So you have Anshei Yoav, one special forces, Kreti V'Apleti, another group of special forces, and the Tzva Giborim, the third set of special forces. There is a Medrash, there's a Gemara that interprets Kreti V'Apleti midrashically as a reference to the Urim V'Tumim, the breastplate of the Choshen Mishpat. Again, from a Pshat perspective, it's a hard jump to make. But just be aware that that is the Medrash's approach. Vayetzu miYerushalayim lirdof acharei. Who are they chasing?
Sheva ben Bechri.
There's a reason why I keep asking this question. Sheva. A second. Who are they chasing after?
Sheva
ben Bechri. Vayetzu miYerushalayim lirdof acharei Sheva ben Bechri. They come to Yerushalayim and they leave Yerushalayim to chase after Sheva ben Bechri. So let me just understand the geography for a second. If you want to chase after Sheva ben Bichri, what direction are you going to go? From Yerushalayim?
North.
North, because Sheva ben Bichri is from?
Binyamin.
Binyamin. So where did he escape into and kind of, Ish lo alav Yisrael, when he made his proclamation at the beginning of the parak, Ein lanu nachala beven David, Ein lanu chelik beDavid v'lo nachala lanu beven Yishai. Ish lo alav Yisrael. Right? So where are they going back to? The tents in the north. Right? Yisrael's Binyamin north. So if Sheva ben Bichri is hiding amidst the tribes of Israel, he's heading from Sheva Binyamin back to his tribe in Binyamin. He's heading what direction? From Yerushalayim?
No.
North. Where did Amasa go when he left Yerushalayim?
South.
He disappeared?
Apparently, right. He should have gone south.
He went south. Exactly to Ish Yehuda. That's all we know. And then we get to Pasukat. Hey, they get to the great stone by Givon, which is in Binyamin. And who do they see walking towards them, greeting them? Oh, my brothers, great to see you. Shalom Aleichem, I missed you. Who do they see? Amasa ben Yeter comes out to greet them. Where? By the Eben Agdolah Asher, B'Givon, in Shevet, Binyamin. What is Amasa doing in Binyamin? We sent them down south to go and find Shevet Yudai. Disappeared on us for 3 days. Now they found them. Where do they find them? In the north.
Treason. He was committing treason by
I
not
I don't think he was committing
David.
Treason. I'm not sure. I went to that conclusion so fast. We'll get to we will explore the issues. But for now, I just want to get the facts. Amasa balifneh. The Yoav chagur mido levusho. Yoav. Remember I told you that Yoav was with them? Right? Yoav was with them. Yoav had gone out with them, Avishai. Yoav, obviously, you need us. You need it. And you have to give Yoav credit. Because He could have easily have said, you know, you passed over me once with a masabaneta. You passed over me twice, right? You tried to pass over me with Avner. We dealt with Avner. Then you tried to pass over me with a masabaneta. Then when that didn't work, you passed me over again by giving the army to, with the Taz to, my younger, less capable brother by the name of Avishai. Yoav could have easily have turned from David and said, I've had enough of this guy. But one thing about Yoav that you see from the very beginning to the end, he's stronger than David. He's, in many places, he's certainly more of a wild card than David. Sometimes he's even smarter than David. But he's always loyal to David. Loyalty is unquestioned. That's really fascinating about Yoav. Meaning, in the meantime, he meets Amasa, come to them. Yoav chagor midol levusho. And in his military uniform, he has a belt with a sword fastened in its sheath. And as he went forth, it fell, he let it fall, meaning he's walking up to, kind of get the picture of it, right? He's walking up to Amasa to embrace him, and he kind of lets his knife or his spear fall from his left hand. Vayomer Yoav l'Amasa, Hashalom atachi. He said, well with you. And the shock, the look on their faces. I mean, you disappeared from us for 3 days. What happened? We didn't know where you were. And you look well. Are you okay? What's going on? Hashalom atachi. Vatochez yad yemin Yoav bizkan Amasa linshoklo. Yoav took Amasa by the beard with his right hand to kiss him, to bring him close to him, to embrace him, to give him a big bear hug. Amasa lo nishmar mecherev vasher biyad Yoav. Amasa was not heeding the sword that was in Yoav's other hand. Vayakeu bad lachomesh, and so he smote him in the groin with this knife, which is exactly, by the way, how he killed
Avner.
Same expression. Vayishpoch me'av arza, and he disemboweled him. Ve'lo shenalo v'yamot, he didn't have to strike a second time. Ve'yoav v'avishai achiv, v'dav v'achavei sheva ben bechri. Mission A accomplished. Now Yoav and Avishai will finish the job and pursue Sheva ben Bichri. Note this verse, who is now chasing after Sheva ben Bichri?
Yoav.
Yoav and?
Avishai.
Avishai, his brother. Meaning, what just happened? David had appointed Avishai to be the leader of the task force, right?
Wait, I thought
Yoav went with them because Yoav had his group of men there. Anshe Yoav. Amasa comes, surprises them by showing up somewhere in the Givon. So Yoav takes care of it. And by the time we're done, Yoav and Avishai leave together. But who's leading the troops here? It's not Avishai v'Yoav Achiv. It's Yoav v'Avishai Achiv. It's Yoav and Avishai, his brother. So who's taking over now?
Yoav.
Yoav.
Probably so Avishai is going to let him after that. He doesn't want to
Yeah. Nobody's going to stand in Yoav's way. Nobody ever stands in Yoav's way, right? And that, except for Shlomo. That is where Yoav sits. And then we have this little fascinating verse. V'ish amad alav minare Yoav. And there was a man who stood by, one of Yoav's young men, and he made a following proclamation. He stood up with the microphone and he said, "Vayomer, mi asher chafetz bi Yoav, umi asher le David achane Yoav. If you favor Yoav, if you're for David, follow Yoav. Right? If you're for David, follow Yoav. Why? Because Yoav stood up to defend David. So if Yoav stood up to defend David, and you're in favor of being part of David's world, so fall in line with Yoav." It's fascinating. And the loyalty of his men to Joab and Joab's loyalty to David. Just a fascinating juxtaposition, especially after all of the efforts of David to replace Joab in this context. In the meantime, sidebar altogether, Amasa mitkolel badam, Amasa is lying there wallowing in the blood on the highway. V'yar ish ki amad kol am, when they saw the people would come and they would kind of stand there watching this image of Amasa kind of bleeding to death on the side of the road, they realized that that wasn't going to allow them to continue the war. So v'yasef et Amasa min ha'mesila ha'sadeh v'yashtech al ha'beged kasher ra'ah kol alav v'yamad. And so they covered his body, they put him off to the side, and so that way the army could march forward. Kasher hogam min ha'mesila. And once he was removed from the highway, avar kol ish acharei Yoav, the people could now pursue Yoav without being distracted as they pursued acharei Sheva ben Bichri. ויעבור בכל שבטי ישראל אבלו בית מאחר בכל בימים ויקהלו ויבוא אחריו. The rest of the story we'll talk deal with Bezrat Hashem next week or the week after, what happened with Sheva ben Bichri. So to summarize what we've seen, the pieces of the story, right? David's, I'm going to actually stop sharing for a second, right? The pieces of the story, David's efforts to replace Yoav with Amasa on the one hand, Avishai on the other, neither very successful, because at the end of the day, Yoav is Yoav, and he will find a way to assert himself. The effort to gather all the forces together and fight Sheva ben Bichri on a frontal attack with the full army of Shevet Yehudah fails. We don't know why it failed yet. We haven't addressed the question of what happened to Amasa. Why did that initial mission to gather the army for 3 days, why did that not work? What happened to the army? What happened to Shevet Yehuda? What happened to Amasa? Amasa failed. Why did he fail? And in the end, where they did find Amasa is the most suspicious of all, because as Debbie correctly pointed out, what is he doing in Shevet Binyamin? That's very suspicious. I mean, it's not hard to figure out what Yoav thought he was doing in Shevet Binyamin. Ultimately, the question is, objectively, what was going on? So we will have to explore all of those pieces as we continue in this story. We will, Bezrat Hashem, reconvene next week. Now, with that, I'm going to finish the shiur today, and I'm going to actually stop recording.